Ready to go. Ready to go. Go.
The CMU podcast in association with 7 Digital.
This week, SoundCloud, Sony Music, and gig licensing. It's the CMU podcast, looking back at the last week in the music business. I'm Andy Malt. With me is Chris Cook. We've just had lunch.
As discussed on last week's CMU podcast, it was the UK music, business, journalists, music journalists. Were there any journalists?
Well, there's a lot of people there who aren't journalists.
It's sort of,
say there's more people who aren't journalists than there are journalists at that lunch.
But it's the journalist lunch held by UK Music, and all the various trade bodies are there. The PR people from all the trade bodies are there.
Some government people.
Some government people were there, and other sort of, yeah. So we... That's what the event's... I mean, everyone now is fully up to speed about what this event
is.
On last week's podcast, I preempted the fact that we were going to this lunch and that we would be recording the podcast immediately after the lunch. And you said, because of that, you were going to resist not only the free champagne when you arrived, mm-hmm. but also the free wine over lunch. Mm-hmm. So how did you do?
Well, I had a glass of champagne when I arrived. And then I had one glass of wine.
One glass of wine.
And then I repeatedly refused wine.
Did you?
Throughout the meal.
They were very good at trying to top up your glass. I don't drink.
Yeah.
Yet they still were constantly trying to top up my...
I could see you on the other side of the room refusing wine.
Empty
it was quite
glass.
Amusing.
Yes.
I was sitting next to someone who doesn't drink as well, so it became a thing.
It became a thing. So a glass of champagne, glass of wine. So you're treating that as being responsible.
Yeah.
Ahead. And it was quite a big meal, so I suppose you were drinking at the same time as eating. It was very good roast turkey, very festive. Apparently you ended up with duck, but you didn't know it was a duck.
Well, they told me it was turkey.
It was a very duck-looking...
Yeah, it was very duck-looking.
turkey. But
it was nice. I enjoyed it. So I'm glad I had it.
A festive duck. Was it Christmassy? I don't know, what makes it Christmassy?
What makes any meat Christmassy, really, other than imagining it to be Christmassy?
Turkey's very Christmassy.
Well, it is if you think it is.
I do think it is.
Yeah, but you eat turkey all year round. Do you think it's Christmassy every time?
I do. I'm one of those people that celebrates Christmas all year round.
Right.
I have a little Christmas tree in the corner of my house all year round. I have tinsel all around. I'm one of those people that celebrates Christmas. I do actually quite enjoy, normally around about July, doing one of two things, which is either putting a Christmas songs playlist on Spotify on,
mm-hmm.
or going through all the sort of sitcoms that are on Netflix and specifically watching the Christmas specials.
Do you really?
I do that.
You can't even wait a whole year to do that.
It's not that I can't wait. It just sort of amuses me watching Christmas specials in July. I just find it funny.
You're easily amused.
I am. I was in my local cafe having lunch earlier this week. I also roast turkey.
Yeah.
Surprise, surprise. And they had obviously a Christmas number ones. I don't know if it's a Spotify playlist or whether it was, I think there probably is an album out there called Christmas number ones. Anyway, it was all Christmas number ones. They were all playing one after the other. And then I can't remember whether you talked about this on the podcast or whether
you wrote about it.
It was quite funny because it's all very festive and all the usual suspects. And then I suppose songs like, I mean, Pet Shop Boys, Always on Your Mind was a Christmas number one. That's mm-hmm. not Christmassy, is it? But there were other songs. Oh, and then there was East 17's Stay Another Day. Yeah. The lovely Christmassy ballad all about suicide.
Yep.
That's always fun. Makes you feel festive. And then, of course, Rage Against the Machine comes blaring on because of that year where we all thought it would be... It was in the days where you could get things to number one if everyone downloaded a track.
Yeah.
And we all thought it would be funny to stop... was it Joe McKeldry?
Yes.
I sort of feel sorry for him. I was like, oh, he sort of came across as being quite a nice guy. We all decided to deprive him of his Christmas number one. And we all downloaded Rage Against the Machine, Killing in the Name of.
Yes.
And...
is it just Killing in the Name?
I think it's just Killing in the Name. Yeah. That's why I paused.
Yeah.
You should have
paused longer. It's like forever.
Matt will edit it out and it'll sound like I knew what the name of the song was.
Stick in a jingle.
And
the edit jingle.
As I think you either said in that article earlier this month or you said it to me in passing, it's a great achievement that we've made that a Christmas song.
Yeah. The article you're referencing, as I said, the highlight of Christmas last year was I'd had a Christmas number ones playlist on. Playing through lunch, playing since the morning, I think. And, you know, obviously that's quite a long playlist. And then just in the post-lunch nap period, suddenly that song tore through the living room and I pretended to be asleep because I was the only person who knew how to stop that from being on.
And then there was a couple of families in the cafe, and it gets quite sweary at the end.
It does, doesn't it?
And it was sort of like, will they realise, do they know that that's what's coming? But I think everyone was oblivious to it. They didn't really notice.
Oh, this is festive.
And then, obviously, it wasn't playing in order, because immediately, as in chronological order,
yeah,
because immediately after that, it segued into the NHS choir. Was that last year's Christmas number one?
Oh, probably, yeah.
Singing Bridge Over Troubled Water and some Coldplay song that, for some reason, they... I don't know why they felt they had to mash that in.
Well, Bridge Over Troubled Water is not enough of a classic, is it?
Put a bit of Chris Martin's lyrics in there. But that was an interesting segue to go from Rage Against the Machine.
Well, where? Like anything.
But it's true, particularly on a Christmas number one.
There is no easy segue from Rage Against the Machine to any other Christmas number one.
With the exception, of course, of Bob the Builder. That would be a great segue.
That would be quite a good segue.
A great little segue there. Anyway, it's Christmas! Nearly.
Yeah, it is nearly, yeah.
Not quite. Next week will be the final See Me podcast of 2017.
No, it won't.
Yes, it will.
No, it won't.
Why won't it?
Because it's not 2017.
Oh, is it not? I've done that before, haven't I? I always do that. Because all the documents I've been writing of late have all been about stuff happening in January and February. I'm already in 2017.
Do you want to have another run at that?
You old-timers. Next week's podcast will be the final podcast of 2016. I was really confused for a moment there. I thought we were doing a podcast between Christmas and New Year that I wasn't aware of. Next week will be the last CMU podcast of 2016, and it will be our review of the year podcast.
It will.
So we'll be looking back at the last... What's the slogan you say at the start?
Well, it sort of changes, but it will be looking back at the last year in the music business.
So you've got a whole week to prepare the alternative introduction.
Well, I've just prepared it.
In fact,
we can just edit that bit out and stick it in next week.
Good. That's a bit of next week's work saved. So that's next week's podcast. But this week's podcast is looking back at the last week in music. It's been a bit of a quiet week. Because it's nearly Christmas, which is why it doesn't matter that we've now waffled on for about half the podcast about lunch. Because
that's more interesting than anything that's happened.
Not a lot's happened this week. And the things that have happened, although interesting...
Interesting things have happened. But I don't want to sell our podcast short at this early stage. You should still listen.
Most of these won't... Well, one of them is a story we've definitely talked about before, and basically the update is, it ain't happening. And then the other two shouldn't take that long to talk about. So, although this has been an incredibly long intro, this actually... Fingers crossed, should be a shorter than normal podcast before next week's review of the year.
Next week's mega podcast. Next week's. Which is going to be 6 hours.
92 hours podcast. Right, it'll be such a long podcast, it will be the last podcast of 2017 because that's how long it'll take to listen to it.
Yes. So, well, let's have a look at what we are going to talk about later on in the podcast. We'll have a look at revamps and possible revamps at Sony Music. We'll be looking at the government's denial that music has any cultural benefit.
Slight paraphrase.
Very slight.
Of the statement there.
Not fans of culture, the government. You might have noticed, not fans of most things. But first, let's talk about how Spotify is not going to buy SoundCloud. Because Spotify is not going to buy SoundCloud.
Which is news, because we thought they might do.
Yeah. I mean, I thought that was a given.
So I'm pretty sure we talked about this on the podcast at some point earlier this year.
Oh, we did.
So, good old SoundCloud. We have said on many occasions that 2016 was the make or break year for SoundCloud. Although it has to be said, they didn't make it. But to be fair, they didn't break it either.
They quite broken it.
No. So we were wrong. But hey, 2017 is going to be the make or break year for SoundCloud. And a lot of people...
This is becoming a bit like... Do you remember when you spent 7 years predicting that MySpace was going to shut down next month?
And it's still going, isn't it? Yeah. But I mean, not really. I mean, it's technically still going, but not really. But SoundCloud, obviously, its development this year is they finally got all their licenses sorted. So they are now, in theory, a licensed streaming service. They've got deals in place with the majors and the indies and the publishers. And you can pay SoundCloud money to get a sort of Spotify-style experience. Or if you don't do that, they'll start shunting adverts in your direction. So in most markets, I don't think it is most markets yet. In some markets, they are putting advertising around content and then sharing the ad income with content creators. So that's the development for SoundCloud
this
year.
In the UK, it seems to only be adverts for TuneCore.
So that's one advertiser.
Oh, yeah. I mean, it's more than none.
It's a start.
But it's less than some.
If any of you listen to Spotify on the free version, it's not like that. They have many advertisers. So if you exclude their own ads and ads for record companies, which are probably bundled in, they're not getting paid for that. As far as I can see, the government sometimes advertises on there.
That's strange for them. They don't really like culture.
Pretty much it. But most people, is it most people? Hey, who cares about most people? I think.
Yeah.
For SoundCloud to have a long-term future, they need to be bought by somebody as a standalone company.
Well, I think SoundCloud would probably tell you that. Well, they wouldn't tell you that, but that's what they're thinking. I mean, they have been trying to sell for quite a long time.
Because they have these licensing deals in place, but it's expensive being in the streaming game. They've got some very big competitors in the subscription market. I mean, that's where you can potentially make money in the long term as a streaming service. Not that anybody is yet, but in theory, you could. But to take on Spotify and Apple Music, let alone Amazon entering this market, is an incredibly difficult thing to do. And although SoundCloud have raised some new finance, both equity finance and debt finance in the last year or so, they don't have enough money to do that. And although they do have a big network of particularly sort of really geeky music fans, early adopter music fans, I would suspect a lot of people who are quite avid SoundCloud users and they go to SoundCloud for the very new stuff are also Spotify subscribers. Yep. And what they do is they use SoundCloud to discover, and as soon as they've discovered, they add it to a Spotify playlist and then they actually listen to it day to day on Spotify. So it's going to be really hard for SoundCloud to make the subscription thing work. Nobody's making ad-funded work. And YouTube has the most potential for making ad-funded work. So as a standalone service, SoundCloud, I believe, are going to struggle to be a success long-term. So they need to be bought. But the problem is, who would buy them? Particularly given how bloody highly, because of all the equity they've raised over the years.
Yeah.
Something like
700 million. And I mean, that's just... No, I mean, that's not going to work for anyone, is it?
No, it's an overvalued company.
Well, Spotify is an overvalued company. They're all overvalued, aren't they? It's a big problem for everyone.
First of all, there aren't that many people who could afford to write a check for 700 million. And even if you could, why would you? I mean, Apple could. Apple could buy it tomorrow just for, I don't know, the Christmas party to hand out as Secret Santa gifts. I don't know.
But SoundCloud? You've not thought this through.
They could buy it and then, I don't know, slice it up and hand it out. Yeah, that doesn't really work, does it? The point is, Apple could buy it tomorrow, no problems. But why would they want it? And in many ways, Spotify has been linked to SoundCloud on a number of occasions over the years. And some people are like, well, why would Spotify want SoundCloud? That's nonsense. Basically, everything that SoundCloud's got, Spotify's already got. Why would they want it? There is a certain logic to the deal, which I think I probably said on the podcast. I've certainly said in the CMU Daily, in that it's a big network of music fans that SoundCloud have. And although there will be a sizable crossover in terms of SoundCloud users and already existing Spotify users, what Spotify needs is platforms via which it can sell its premium. And obviously that's its disadvantage to, say, Apple, that have the iOS platform and they have iTunes where they can sell Apple Music. The reason why Spotify has to have the big freemium service is that provides the platform through which they can try and upsell the premium subscriptions. Taking over SoundCloud would give them another audience to sell premium subscriptions to. And possibly, because it's my belief that once Spotify have enough premium subscribers, they'll shut Free down. Because Free is a loss leader for everybody. The labels don't make much money. The artists don't like it because they don't get much money. And Spotify lose money on Free. But they need Free to sell paid for. So at the moment, it's a necessary loss leader. But conceivably, if they bought SoundCloud, they could shut down Spotify Free. That would then be good PR, because shutting down the free version of Spotify, whenever they do it, if they do it, is going to be tricky from a PR point of view. But if they bought SoundCloud, at that point, they could say, OK, we're shutting down Spotify Free. SoundCloud is going to be our free platform. Try and strike up decent deals with the labels on the basis that A, it's great promo for individual artists. B, it's how we now upsell premium Spotify subscriptions, and try and make that work. So there was a logic to these talks. And, you know, the rumours were, and sources were speaking to the Financial Times, which is normally quite reliable, that there were some quite serious talks going on between Spotify and SoundCloud in recent months.
Yeah.
But unsurprisingly, they couldn't agree on price point. Because, I mean, however valuable SoundCloud might have been to Spotify, and I assume it would have been a bit of an equity deal, because in the run-up to Spotify's IPO, if Spotify could do a share swap deal so it wasn't actually writing a cheque and handing over cash, but even then, 700 million, they're not going to pay that. And so clearly they couldn't get SoundCloud down enough. I think Spotify were also nervous, this is certainly what the sources were saying, that if they entered into an unfavourable deal with SoundCloud, they are now very much marching towards that IPO. They don't want a massive spend or indeed the licensing challenges. Often when a service gets bought. You have to go back to the labels and publishers and renegotiate all the licensing deals. And there was a fear that if they did it for the wrong price or all the licensing nightmares, would that then delay the IPO? And as we've talked about on the podcast before, Spotify need to IPO next year because they borrowed some money.
Yeah.
Was it earlier this year, last year? Where basically the terms of those loans are sort of linked to an IPO, and the longer they leave the IPO, the more expensive that finance becomes for the Spotify business. So the news this week via those sources is it's off. They were serious talks. They did get quite far down the road, but it ain't happening. So for Spotify, there were logic to that deal, but it's not essential to them. SoundCloud, I mean, they keep doing interviews and being positive about the future. But OK, 2016 was not a make or break year, but they didn't make it.
Well, you say, I mean, it could end up having been the make or break year. I mean, if not Spotify, who would buy SoundCloud? It's not a very long list of people who it would make sense for. The days when people would just throw money at streaming services because it was the cool new thing. I mean, they may have got SoundCloud where it got today, but those days are gone. Therefore, does SoundCloud have a future?
So 2017 will be an interesting year for SoundCloud. I mean, SoundCloud still plays an important role, particularly in promoting new music. It's certainly where bookers and A&Rs and journalists and the really sort of geeky early adopters, who often are the people who add things to their Spotify playlists, then kickstarting that complicated algorithm that drives all the automated playlisting on Spotify. SoundCloud plays a really important role. If SoundCloud was to shut down tomorrow from a sort of music discovery in terms of industry and early adopters, it would be a massive hole.
Yeah, no, as downbeat and possibly dismissive as I sound, it would make my job considerably more difficult if SoundCloud suddenly disappeared.
Which makes you think that if it reaches a brink and actually it becomes available at a much cheaper price...
I'll buy it.
Well, either Andy Malt will buy it, or depending where Spotify is...
I mean, if
is,
it's going down to $700, as I've written in the notes, I would consider it.
Well, I think you probably would find that someone would buy it at $750, and you would have missed the opportunity.
I'd go up to $1,000 for SoundCloud.
Would you?
Yeah.
Well, it's on... I
know you're supposed to play your cards a bit close to your chest, but I'm going to put that out there now.
On the record... That hey SoundCloud, if nothing else.
Hey, coming up to Christmas, you could buy some nice presents for $1,000.
For $1,000. If the price did come down, my point is perhaps the industry would buy it. Perhaps Vivendi or Universal would buy it. Perhaps, you know, somebody within the music business would buy it. Not music industry couldn't afford it anywhere near at the current price point. But if they reach the brink, well, either Spotify or Apple will swoop in, or perhaps somebody from the music business might step in and get it. But we'll see.
Maybe Justin Timberlake could
come in.
Look what he did for MySpace.
Perhaps that is the future. 2017 will be the make or break year, and Timberlake will make it. That's something to look forward to.
Still to come, we'll be looking at a few of this week's other stories in brief. We'll be looking at the government's attack on culture. I might be building this story up a bit.
I think you are.
Anyway, the government's attack on culture.
to the extent that we might get sued for libel. But I'm looking forward to it.
The government's attack on culture because they hate culture. But now let's talk about revamping Sony.
So two,
in many, many ways.
Two stories this week coming out of Sony Music.
One of them true, one of them probably not.
One of them idle speculation, one something that was formally, officially announced in a press release.
Yeah.
So let's do the idle speculation first, because that's more fun. This is coming from, I believe, the New York Post.
Yeah.
I think that's where this story originated.
The ever reliable.
So this is rumours coming out of the US that Sony Corp is planning a rejig. So this story requires a little bit of knowledge of the structure of the Sony wider business.
Which I'm sure everyone listening has, and so we're not going to explain it.
So outside of Japan...
Oh, you are going to explain it.
Outside of Japan, most of Sony's entertainment business is run out of the US, okay? So the Sony Music Japan, Sony Music Publishing Japan, they're all standalone little businesses.
Yeah.
But for the rest of the world, it all sits in the US and then has divisions all around the world. And in the Sony Corp of America business, there are various strands. But I suppose in terms of entertainment, there is Sony Entertainment, which then breaks down into the TV and movie business, so the studios, and then the two music companies, so Sony Music, the record company, Sony ATV, the publishing company. And then there's a whole separate division, which is now called, used to be called Sony Computer Entertainment, but computers officially out of favour, so it's now called Sony Interactive Entertainment, because of course you don't interact with any of the other forms of entertainment. You just go into a coma as soon as a movie comes on.
Well, we've learned a lot of interesting things about interacting this week, haven't we? So, Ticketmaster's interactive Robbie Williams ticket.
More on which.
Different to other tickets.
More on which later. Mm. So you have these two divisions, Sony Entertainment and Sony Interactive Entertainment. The Sony Entertainment business isn't really a division. Film and TV and then the music companies sort of operate separately from each other, but they all join up at the top. And basically, Michael Linton, who runs the Sony film and TV business, also has a second role overseeing the Sony Entertainment division, in which you also find the music companies. The rumour is that there's going to be a rejig of the Sony corporate hierarchy and structure in the US, so that the film and TV bit, which has been flagging of late, it will sit under Sony Interactive, which obviously has all things PlayStation, so that's been doing very well of late, which would then leave the music companies on their own.
Yes.
And the talk is that this Michael Linton is actually looking to leave the company, possibly go into academia. He also is an investor in Snapchat in his own capacity, so there's talk maybe he might go and have an executive role at Snapchat. So he will leave, movie or TV will go and sit with Sony Interactive, and then what happens to the music companies? And the talk is it might mean that then you have a new little department called Sony Music, and we talked on the podcast this year how Sony ATV, the publishing bit, the music publishing bit of the business, used to be a joint venture with the Michael Jackson estate.
Yes.
And as a result of that, I mean, it's quite common. I mean, at Universal, the labels and the publishing side of the business sort of sit separately from each other, but they are joined up very much at the top. And same with Warner, and the same with most indie music companies. Whereas Sony Music, the labels, Sony ATV Publishing are totally separate businesses, different CEOs, and they operate very autonomously. Mainly because, up until recently, Sony didn't own the publisher outright. Now it does, because it bought out the Michael Jackson estate. And so, therefore, it sort of seems that because Sony now controls those two businesses outright, it's sort of logical that they will become slightly closer together. And this potential rejig of the entire US business might result in that happening. So, all very interesting, albeit idle speculation, which Sony Corp deny.
Yes, quite firmly deny. They said it was nothing but baseless rumour and speculation.
So basically, the last 4 minutes of this podcast have been entirely baseless rumour and speculation.
Yes, but the New York Post said we were expecting a decision by the end of March.
Yes, so they have the classic financial year, yeah. And the thinking was that any decision on this would be in place before the end of this financial year, which basically means by the end of March.
A thing that has actually happened and is not speculation, because Sony said it happened, is that there's been some rejigging at Sony Music UK.
Yes, a rejig of the top people within the frontline labels at Sony Music UK. So as with all the major record companies, within the UK, Sony Music actually has a number of divisions called frontline labels. So as an artist, you don't sign to Sony, you sign to one of the Sony labels. So the frontline labels in the UK, the main ones, are Syco and RCA, and Columbia are the big three, but then there's also the smaller ones like Epic and Black Butter. And as of earlier this year, Ministry of Sound Recordings, because they bought the label side of Ministry of Sound.
They did.
So you have all these frontline labels at Sony, like you do with equivalents at other major record companies. And what has happened in the last month, basically, is that the two big ones are RCA and Columbia, and they've both had new people coming in to run them, and the old guard who'd been there for quite a while basically leaving the business. So quite a shake-up of the sort of the senior management within Sony Music. So the people who had been running Columbia left.
Alison Donald and Mark Terry.
And they were replaced by, well, Jason Iley, who runs Sony Music UK, used to work at Universal. And basically one of his former colleagues at Universal has joined Sony, and he is now running the Columbia side of the business.
So Ferdy Unger Hamilton,
who is also rumoured to be launching some sort of new JV with Sony as well. That was what we thought he'd gone in there to do, but then he took over Columbia. On the RCA side, basically what they're doing is they're going to bring the Ministry label I mentioned and the RCA labels together, put them into one unit, and then the guy who has been running Ministry of Sound Recordings is going to run that combined unit.
So that's David Dollymore.
And then the two bits of that unit, Ministry and RCA, will then also have MDs who are being promoted from within.
So that's Dipesh Palmer and Neil Hughes.
Respectively.
Yeah.
Ministry and RCA.
Correct.
So yes, lots of rejigs going on at the top of Sony Music UK, and that's very much, I suppose, Jason, who joined the company. I mean, he's been there a while now, but still relatively recently in the wider scheme of things, and I suppose that's him now having a brand new team that he sort of put in place, and he was very much positioning this restructure and the recent sort of moving around of senior executives of Sony ready now to power forward, very vibrant UK division, into the new year. Well, those weren't the exact words he used, but it was words to that effect.
Yeah, so obviously big plans for Sony going into 2017 to remain the second biggest major. I can't see it becoming bigger than Universal or dropping smaller than Warner. But, you know, aiming to be successful.
And, of course, all that rejigging at the top of Sony Music. Just in time for headquarters in the US to say, hey, Sony Music UK, hey, Sony ATV UK, we're going to work closer together now. Sort out your senior management and rejig. My prediction for 2017. Because restructures normally preempt another restructure somewhere along the line. But it gives us something to talk about on the podcast.
Yes.
So that's good. And it will be interesting to see, obviously, RCA Columbia, two of the real classic label brands that go way back to the early days of the record industry. And it is always interesting when you sort of get a bit of new opinions and new views, particularly, I mean, all of those people have an A&R background. And it'll be interesting to see if that has any changes on both the artists who they sign new and also the output of the more established names that they work with.
Meanwhile, one last bit of Sony news just in at the time we're recording this. Obviously, it's old news by the time you hear it.
Old news alert, everybody.
But news just in, I've just arrived in my inbox.
So is another bit of Sony Music rejigging / reappointing news.
Yes.
This time Psycho. I mentioned Psycho.
You did mention Psycho.
Psycho's part of Sony.
Well done.
Thank you.
A round of applause for Chris. Psycho's president, Sonny Takkar, is leaving the company, having worked with Simon Cowell since 1997.
Yeah, very long time.
He's going to set up a new entertainment business in LA.
So who's going to run Psycho?
Apparently maintaining links with Psycho, though, he reckons.
Who's going to run it, though?
Well, Tyler Brown, there have been three internal promotions, not into his position, but Tyler Brown has been appointed managing director. Anya Jones has been named head of A&R, and Guy Langley is now senior A&R manager. And I can give you all their ages for some reason, thanks to this press release, if you really want to know.
I don't.
They're all in the early to mid-30s mark.
Okay, so some rejigs at Psycho, as well as those rejigs at Sony Music UK, and those totally baseless, definitely not happening, but probably happening rejigs across Sony Corp in the US, and as a result of that, maybe some rejigging going on with the Sony hierarchy worldwide.
Yeah, so the news is there's all kinds of jigging going on at Sony.
Yeah.
And not just because it's Christmas.
Though mainly.
Quick look at some news in brief now.
Super quick, super brief.
Super quick, super brief look at other stories that have happened this week. The music industry has written an open letter to Donald Trump.
Yes.
Yeah, so I'm sure we don't normally report on, definitely not this frequent number of letters to a new president. Or any. I don't remember ever reporting on this before. Everyone's getting their letters in.
Did the music industry write letters to Obama back in the day? Assume
Donald Trump is not yet president, and yet we've already reported on him more than any other US president in history.
So the National Music Publishers Association got its letter into Donald Trump very early on, not long after the election. This letter was from the entire US music industry, every trade body you could possibly think of for the US music industry, and several more I didn't know
yeah,
existed.
Yeah, some real obscure ones there. I mean, that's, you know, it's the obscure ones I really like.
Put their name to this letter.
Not into the mainstream trade bodies.
Going to Donald Trump, it was basically preempting. Donald Trump had quite a high-profile meeting with all the Silicon Valley chiefs, because, of course, Silicon Valley is known for being a little bit left-leaning and not really necessarily being an obvious pro-Trump massive. But he met with all the senior people from all the big tech companies. And so this was the music industry sort of getting their opinions in. The assumption is that big tech are going to be saying, those safe harbours in the Digital Millennium Copyright Act, they're brilliant, they are. Keep them as they are. Whereas the music industry would like the safe harbours restricted. So they were getting their letter in saying, music's great, tech's great, but safe harbours, piracy, bloody Google. They didn't actually say that, but that's basically what they meant.
That sounded quite a lot like a Donald Trump speech there.
It did, didn't it?
Except some random sounds.
I didn't repeat anything. You'd have to go, bloody Google, bloody, bloody Google. Bloody, bloody, bloody Google. That would be a bit more.
Yeah, but he tended to do that at each different rally. He added words. Like when he started off saying, it's going to be like Brexit, and then he got an applause. So the next rally, and it's going to be Brexit times two. And then it became like, eventually became Brexit times five. Next week's podcast, you can
talk it
say
up
bloody,
to that
bloody.
Extent.
Google.
Okay. So, yes, so they sent a letter to Donald Trump. I guess he probably didn't read it. But he presumably, unless something happens at that electoral college, will be president by the time we're back. Well, not quite by the time we're back underway in January.
No, I think we'll be back slightly before the end of all human
existence.
Before
the end of the world. But hopefully at some point between now and whenever it is in January he becomes president, he'll get to the bottom of his post bag and read both the letters that have so far been sent by the music industry. Although, I assume Kanye covered it all.
Well, Kanye, he did also, that was the other thing that happened this week, wasn't it? He met with Kanye. It was an interesting thing where they had this sort of photo call afterwards. Donald Trump was saying, oh, you know, we've just been friends for a long time. We were just discussing life, just chatting. And Kanye didn't really say anything at that point, and then later tweeted, I raised multicultural issues, educational reform, violence. And it's like, these don't sound like shooting the breeze.
But the other sort of...
But I wonder if that was just, like, Donald Trump didn't really hear anything.
Yet he wasn't listening. He was
so
just,
I think Kanye said something, I'm sure.
But obviously Kanye had, in the past, had expressed his own ambitions to be president of these United States. And now that we seem to be in an age where random celebrities...
Suddenly that doesn't seem like such an outlandish proposition
it really
anymore.
It doesn't, does it? I mean, that's one
it's
of
like
them.
Kanye, that'd be a nice change.
But he previously said he might go for it in 2020. He's now talking 2024.
Yeah.
Which seems to be him saying he wouldn't want to run against his old mate Donald Trump in 2020. Whatever's left with the world in 2024, Kanye will take over. So, if nothing happens for the safe harbours in the next 8 years, and let's face it, they probably won't, perhaps come 2024, the music industry will be top of the list, and it will be the tech lobby having to send pointless open letters to try and get their voice heard. Anyway, that was neither brief nor quick. Let's do the rest.
Festival is moving.
So Festival will no longer be on the Isle of Wight. It will now be in Dorset.
No, it will be in Dorset.
I couldn't remember if it was Dorset or Devon. That's why I sort of stuttered on that. So after being on the Isle of Wight forever, in Festival terms, it will now be on the mainland of England.
Yes, in the Lulworth Estate, where Camp Festival already takes place. Good place for a festival.
It is.
Lulworth is a very beautiful area.
And also,
I think it was an interview Rob DeBank gave to Music Week, where they said, is this just going to be Camp Festival?
But bigger.
And he was like, no, the Lulworth Estate is very big. So he sort of suggested that it's going to be in a different bit of the Lulworth Estate. And to be fair, it is very big. But that's obviously, that's a big change. They talk also about they're not leaving the Isle of Wight entirely.
Well, because since they've been on the Isle of Wight, they've supported various charities there. And I think they've done sort of some educational music. So it's also implying that they'll carry on doing that sort of outreach work.
But in terms of continuing to be a competitive and financially viable festival, they needed to come onto the mainland, where there are some costs.
Which is interesting, because we didn't actually mention this.
Or savings to be made, rather.
We didn't mention this in our story in the CMU Daily, but as we're being super quick and super brief in this super quick...
I've noticed we definitely are.
Super brief section of the podcast. It sort of links, remember, to the Isle of Wight Festival saying exactly the same things earlier this year, that they couldn't afford to make it a commercially viable event on the island unless various things changed. Yeah. Now, they then went ahead and announced their dates, 2017, so presumably behind the scenes they managed, but it sort of seems like, obviously, there are costs to putting everything on an island, everything across a bit of sea, and it's making it tricky to make it work in the festival market on the island, although the Isle of Wight's a great place to put a festival, so interesting.
Robbie Williams, as previously mentioned, is putting out the world's first interactive ticket, which is Ticketmaster's fairly bold claim, given that all tickets are interactive, because handing them over to a bouncer to have them checked, that is interactive.
There is some interaction going on.
If you're going to be picky about this. But Ticketmaster have teamed up with Shazam to put a QR code on Robbie Williams tickets so you can scan a QR code and it'll play a video or something.
You're forgetting the collector ticket part of this.
I wasn't, but...
There are two stages to this. First of all, Ticketmaster have the collector ticket. Yeah. So rather than you collecting the actual ticket...
Yeah, Ticketmaster have introduced the first ticket you can keep and the first interactive ticket. Well done, Ticketmaster, for your amazing innovations.
So you get a little credit card type ticket that you wear around your neck, and then it has a barcode on it, and you scan it and you get an exclusive Robbie video. It's the future, everybody!
What a load of shit.
But of course, as we all know, interactivity around ticketing is what you're interested in.
No.
Get on StubHub and sell your tickets. There's nothing more
interactive. That's quite interactive,
There's nothing more interactive than becoming a ticket tout. So if you genuinely are a real live music fan and you like interactivity, become a ticket tout in 2017. That's our message.
Neil Young's Pono is planning to move into high-quality streaming.
Did we confirm it was Pono, not Pono?
I don't care what it is. It's fucking rubbish.
So this was...
Sorry, this podcast has become a lot more sweary than normal
in the last 8 seconds.
As long-term readers of CMU will know that I struggle with Pono.
Anyone who pays attention to certainly the CMU Daily will know. Neil Young attempted to launch a high audio quality download service. He launched it just as downloads peaked and went into decline. And
he launched it with a portable music player that was designed so that it would not fit into any pocket.
So, yes, a portable music player that was not very portable. And he sort of has now accepted that downloads is not the place to be.
Well, mainly because his download provider went out of business.
So he's moving it into streams.
Because it was Omniphone, wasn't it?
Omniphone.
Provided, and Omniphone went into administration and took the Pono download store down with it.
But you still got the little pyramid device on a shelf.
Yeah. I can't imagine anyone uses.
And so he's going to launch a super high audio quality streaming service. And if you're thinking, well, hang on a second, that's what Tidal is. That's what Deezer Elite is. Because you might be one of the two people other than me and Andy who remember that there's a high quality Deezer service in the US called Deezer Elite. But this is going to be even higher quality streaming.
Oh, yeah.
So high quality streaming. Is he going to have a device for this, or is it going to run like on a Sonos?
He said he was hoping to have a presence on phones, so presumably some sort of iPhone or Android app. But the problem is the level of quality that Pono is provided in is above CD quality, i.e., outside the realms of human hearing. Phones really offer that quality.
Just to clarify,
because
it's
pointless.
That doesn't mean that you can't hear it.
You can't hear
the difference.
You can't hear the difference in quality because humans can't hear it.
Also,
not least Neil Young, who's been playing, he must have tinnitus coming out of his eyes,
let alone his ears. But also, who has headphones plugged into their phones that would work on a Sonos system with a really good speaker system, surely? Anyway, Pono is becoming a streaming service in 2017.
Well, not even in 20, but that's what they're looking at, presumably 2017.
He'll have a Kickstarter campaign, he'll raise another million.
But that'll make the Pono players that have no internet connection, it'll make them useless. So you have to buy a new, well, you get your app for your phone. But it's like he's basically gone, yeah, our download store's out of business and this whole player thing, that's redundant now.
So presumably when he works out that there's no smartphone in the world that can cope with these files, he'll bring out the entirely unportable smartphone.
Yeah.
The Pono phone that you can't use.
You have no internet connection.
Yeah.
You'll have to, streaming will mean you download like an hour-long mix or something. It's just, stop it. Just stop it.
From Andy Malt getting very angry with Neil Young, a heartwarming story to end the In Brief section. Tell us about your heartwarming story. Because normally, obviously we have the And Finally section in the CMU Daily, which obviously is a sort of the old News at 10 And Finally story, which usually on News at 10, occasionally the And Finally's would be funny, but usually they were stories. Whereas our And Finally usually is our...
Look at this idiot.
Our excuse to be even more sarcastic than usual about some poor pop star who's just trying to earn a living. But unusually, we had a story in our And Finally section.
It was more of an Red Hot Chili Peppers drummer Chad Smith opened a new music department in a Bedfordshire secondary school this week.
The band being in the country to tour.
Yes. That still does not explain this story. There is an explanation for it. But
yes.
Even then, a bit odd.
So this secondary school in Bedfordshire had built a new music department.
Yeah.
And so they wanted someone to open it. So they had the drummer from Red Hot Chili Peppers opening it. He gave a little speech. That was all lovely.
He played a drum solo. He did that thing where you get a miniature curtain over a plaque and he pulled that
back. And his name was on it, presumably.
I assume so. Opened by Chad Smith.
And there's a little video of all of this on internet if you're interested.
If you can go and look at it on our website.
Explain to us very quickly, because we're being very quick and very brief this week. Explain to us very quickly why it was that the drummer with the Red Hot Chili Peppers ended up opening a music department at a school in Bedfordshire.
Well, it turns out that the daughter of the chair of the school governors is Emma Banks, who is the Red Hot Chili Peppers agent.
Yes,
so that does make it rather easier to book an international music superstar. Even if it is only the drummer.
So a very high-profile UK booking agent who is not what you know. I mean,
It was, though. I watched this whole speech still going, why did this happen? And right at the end of the speech, she says, oh, and I want to thank my long-term friends, the Banks family. Oh, yeah. Is it Emma here, who we've been friends for a very long time. Oh, Emma. All right, yeah.
And now it all makes sense. A nice message there for the school children of this Bedfordshire school, that it's not what you know, it's who you know. So stop learning stuff and get out there and network. A good little heartwarming message to end this section. Hey, Andy.
There's a great bit in the video where he goes, hey, have we got any musicians in here? Oh, two of you? All right, well, we need to
sort that out. Well, as we're about to discuss, our government doesn't like culture. Yeah. So it's not surprising there are no school kids into their music anymore.
True, yeah. But if you want to watch that video, or if you want to read any of those stories,
where do I go?
You could go to completemusicupdate.com/podcast. You'll find the show notes for this show, and you find all the links to these stories that we just discussed very quickly in brief. And finally this week, it's the government's continued attack on culture and plans to shut down all culture.
At no point in this podcast have you properly explained what this final story is about.
I said gig licensing in the intro.
In the intro you did say gig licensing, and it is sort of...
Gig licensing is boring. I'd rather talk about the government's efforts to cancel all cultural events in the UK.
Last week, in the House of Lords of the Parliament of the United Kingdom of Great Britain and Northern Ireland, we didn't talk about this actually on last week's podcast, although it did happen before last week's podcast. They had a meeting where they talked about the way gigs and concerts are licensed by local authorities here in the UK. And they had a representative of Live Nation, and they had a representative of the Musicians Union, and they had the previously discussed on the podcast Mark David from the Music Venue Trust, all talking about the continued problems around the way gigs and concerts and live music venues are licensed. And all of this stems from the Licensing Act in 2003.
That's correct.
And there were issues with that from the day after it became law. And there were various efforts to try and reform things. We then had the Live Music Bill in,
2011?
I want to say 2010.
Or 9?
You see, well...
All right, 10. Let's go in the middle.
If we go in the middle, it would be 2010. And the Live Music Bill was a private member's bill put forward by a Liberal member of the House of Lords, Tim Clement Jones.
Yo, Tim.
And that was basically to overcome some of the issues that the Licensing Act of 2003 had created. It's quite rare, actually, for private member's bills. So that's a piece of legislation that isn't proposed by government. It's proposed by a member of parliament. And usually those don't actually get through the process to become law. And that one did. So there was some reform. But basically, the conclusion of this meeting last week, which in turn was the conclusion of a bit of research that various members of the House of Lords have been doing, is there is still more work to be done in the way that local authorities license live events. And the proposal that was put forward by Tim Clement Jones was an amendment to the Policing and Crime Bill.
Yeah, it was a little amendment that would add cultural benefits to the community to the criteria in the licensing process.
Yeah, so when a local authority was considering an application to put on a gig or concert or whatever, they have a list. The law gives them a list of things they have to consider.
And they mostly have a quite negative focus.
Exactly. It's sort of like, will it be really noisy? Will it cause disruption? Could there be a public disorder issue around it? And they go down that list, and if they say, nope, right, have your licence. And what Tim Clement Jones and various other lords have supported this, and indeed those three people who spoke last week were all backing this, is, well, there should be something at the bottom that says, think about the cultural benefit. Because things like public disorder is a relative thing, and it's sort of like, will there be public disorder? And then it's sort of, well, let's weigh up the pros and the cons. Okay, there might be a little bit of noise in that street for one night, but given the cultural benefit that it will bring to the local community, then we can probably tolerate a little bit of noise one evening. And that's the sort of conversation that the live industry would like local authorities to have. And it should be said, some local authorities, that's exactly the conversation they would have voluntarily, having been through the checklist. But very much the way gigs are licensed, how easy it is varies greatly around the country. And there are certain parts of the country where it all works fine, and there are others where actually it can be a real pain to get the licenses through. And so the idea was, if we put this into the Act, there'll be a little bit of uniformity and it will work across the country. So the amendment was proposed last week, and then earlier this week it was debated in the House of Lords, and the government's representative basically said, no.
Not into this.
Not interested.
Yeah, so a spokesperson for the government, Carlin Chisholm, got up and just, like you said, not really interested in this. not going to do anything. That's it.
Her line was, well, the whole point of this list is it's considering the negative impact. I think what she was saying was the law is structured to assume that you will grant a licence unless.
Yeah.
And so that's why it's a negative checklist. The starting point is we will grant a licence unless blah, blah, blah. And so that was her
position.
So
it's assumed under current legislation, the cultural benefit would just naturally be something that would be considered at an earlier stage.
Exactly. Almost it's a given that there is a cultural benefit, but we need to consider all these potential negatives. And then if there aren't any boxes ticked, then we acknowledge the cultural benefit and so we grant the license. So that was sort of her position. But a couple of lords spoke out against it, and Tim Clement Jones was amongst them. And he was basically saying, if you speak to the people who are getting licenses for these events around the country, the current system isn't working. And he was sort of saying it's not helpful for the government just to get up and say, hey, current system's fine. Because it's like, well, the fact that we've done this research and we've got all this feedback, the fact that three representatives from live industry, big promoters like Live Nation, and then Mark David representing the grassroots promoters, the fact that all these people have raised these issues and saying that there is this lack of conformity around the country, it's okay, on one level, in theory, you might be right, but clearly there is an issue and it's not helpful to just say, ah, that's all fine.
So Tim Clement Jones withdrew his amendment, although he did say that he believes the Home Office also has a responsibility in this area to help preserve our venues rather than simply stonewalling and saying we've got a very fine licensing act as it is and we don't need any further objectives. You've been in touch with Tim Clement Jones since
then. Yes, because you might think, given what he said in the House of Lords, he put his amendment forward, had a little sparring with the government spokesperson.
And then withdrew it.
So why immediately withdraw it rather than pushing it to go for a vote? But he sort of basically said when I was checking in, well, that's sort of how it works. It generally, with things like this, it takes a few goes in Parliament to finally get it onto the government's agenda. But there isn't really anything to be gained forcing it to a vote, which you will ultimately lose because if it goes to the Commons, then the government sort of, well, not a particularly big majority at the moment, but the government have the sway in the House of Commons. So there's no point forcing it all the way through the process, but it's getting it on the agenda, getting a bit of debate going, making other people in Parliament who aren't necessarily tuned in to music aware this is an issue, so you slowly rally support.
Well, as we've seen with secondary ticketing, I mean, they've had several goes at that, and it's only now that people are saying, oh, yeah, no, you're right, there is a problem.
So for him, it was very much stage one, let's get it on the agenda, have a little debate. Okay, we'll withdraw it for now, but we'll look for other opportunities with other legislation down the line where we can keep going back and saying, no, actually, while technically your interpretation of the law and the system might be right, there's an issue here and we somehow need to address this at some point in the future. And certainly the live industry will be hoping that this issue does come back up in Parliament, because I know when Tim Clement Jones initially put his amendment forward, there are quite a few promoters and venue owners saying, yeah, this is a real problem for us. We'd really like to see this change. It ain't going to happen at this stage, but it might at some point in the future.
Yeah, so that's it for this week. As we've said earlier, it's our last normal podcast for the year. We will be back again next week with our review of 2016.
Which will come out just before Christmas.
Yeah.
So perfect Christmas Day listening.
Yeah.
If you've got the family round and you're worried about the old Spotify Christmas number ones playlist playing the sweary Rage Against the Machine track and offending old aunts or grannies or people like that, then don't put the Spotify Christmas number ones playlist on. Don't even tune into one of those music channels that all play Christmas songs at Christmas. Just put on the CMU podcast and everybody will be in their element.
We won't be discussing Pono, so I won't swear so
much. It's true. We won't be discussing anything that Neil Young has proposed this year.
Because, unfortunately, Pono has not been one of the big things of 2016.
No, so it didn't even close down. So we haven't got anything to say about Pono next week. But we will be talking about what might we talk about in the view of the year?
I don't want to give it away.
I suspect there'll probably be something about streaming in there.
There might be something about streaming. There might be something about secondary ticketing. I'm
rooting for Safe Harbours to get on the shortlist.
Might be, yeah.
So we'll see, I guess.
There'll be some light relief. Tedious stuff like that. We'll lighten the mood.
We will.
Make it festive.
I'm sure we'll return to Ed Sheeran being stabbed in the face.
Yeah,
that will lighten the mood.
That is 2016 for me.
So that's something to look forward to.
Yeah. If you did want to listen to some music, you could do that too. By the time you listen to this podcast, the CMU approved in 2016 playlist will be complete, because we will have finished our last approved column of the year, which is our final artist of 2016. Yeah, if you check in with our playlist on Spotify now, you can listen to our five artists of the year, who were Moddy, Lady Leisure, Anna Meredith, Riz MC, and Frank Ocean.
But not only those five, there's every artist you've ever approved in 2016 that are on Spotify.
Almost, which is most of them. There's only five or six who aren't there. It's about 12 hours of music. So that's ideal for Christmas Day.
It's the perfect, yes.
Morning to evening.
Christmas songs are for listening to in July, as we've already all agreed. Christmas Day is all about new music that no one else in your household will ever have heard of before. And they can be introduced to the top quality music that Andy has been approving this year.
And it is top quality. Anyway, this podcast is presented by me, Andy Malt, and also Chris Cook. And it is produced by Matt Peaty. And for more on CMU, you can go to completemusicupdate.com.
Recorded at Unique Facilities, the CMU podcast is an unlimited production in association with 7 Digital.